happened is that I made some gesture, like crossing my arms and probably pushed the button, so I need to get some holster for this or something. But anyway, there we are, and we'll try to get it all on today. Okay, we're going to cover the last two or three big concepts today and probably slop over into Wednesday. Wednesday we will go back over everything. We'll review. So for Wednesday's class, bring any questions that you have about all of Bronfenbrenner, and we'll prepare for the eco exam, which will be in class a week from today.
Are there going to be any review sessions?
Yes, there will be a review session. That was my next task, which was to ask you if you would prefer to have a review session on Thursday or Friday this week.
Thursday.
How many of you would like a review session early Thursday afternoon? Late Thursday afternoon? Friday morning? Friday afternoon? Sunday afternoon? I didn't say that. What? Yeah. I don't know. She may be ready to get rid of me. Okay. Friday afternoon, huh? Friday afternoon? Early? Early Friday afternoon? Okay. Late Friday afternoon? Friday morning? What? Sure. Yeah. What I want actually is sort of an idea of how many people would show up. Okay, and how many of you preferred Thursday afternoon? Let's do two. One Thursday afternoon, one Friday afternoon. How many of you would come to one if there was one on Thursday afternoon and one on Friday afternoon, or both? I don't know. Okay. Okay. We'll schedule two. You don't have anything else to do. No. Sorry. I don't have anything else to do. So, what the heck? Count my hours. Okay. Exercise 3 will be available in class Wednesday. How are they? They're good. All right. People actually chose 3 settings, and they were actually physical places. Okay, that's. And they talked about the variety of links among the settings, how each pair were connected by people. Of course, all of them were connected by a direct link, you. Some of them were connected by supplemental links, other people. Some of them were connected by communication, intersetting communication. Some of them were connected by intersetting knowledge. Some of them were connected by various combinations of those. Okay, that's true of any settings. They can be combined, connected in all of those ways. And then, how did they do on the hypotheses? Pretty well. Okay. That means Julie is being able to breeze through them. The better you do, the faster she goes. Right? And the more points you get. Yeah. Okay. Did you get your paper done? All right. Questions? The stuff from the overheads on the web. Oh, no, the eco exam only covers the stuff in the Developology book, very, very strictly related to the book itself. Yeah, yeah, Developology, okay. The other stuff will be on the final exam, but... Also remind the Renkel article I didn't take over. Remind me. I will do, I don't know the specific times or places. I will announce those after we schedule them. It takes a day or two to get, because we have to do them online through the web viewer thingy, and it's, you know, used to be I could pick up the phone and say, can I have X room? And they would say yes, and now I have to go through and two people have to, anyway, and then I get an email I can't open, you know, things like that. I will announce them on Wednesday. I will also email the entire class to announce them, and I'll put them on the web as soon as they're confirmed. So there'll be one Wednesday afternoon, one Thursday afternoon, one Friday afternoon. Yes? That's why I asked. Any other questions? And there weren't any, and I thought nobody was going to ask about the eco exam. Because I explained it all on Wednesday last week, and so I figured everybody just had all their questions. No, I'm good. I'm glad you didn't. The format, objective. It's very straightforward. You will have to recognize the definitions. You don't have to recall them, you just have to recognize that this is the definition of mesosystem, and this is the definition of a relation, and this is the definition of a dyad, you know, those sorts of things. There'll be a section asking you some of the questions that are in the syllabus. There was a page that said, this is what you're expected to know. Review that page. It's right in the syllabus. Okay. Expectations for the eco exam. So read through that and make sure that you can apply the information in the ways that are described there. Okay. So we'll ask you, for example, if you wanted to create a relationship, a dyadic relation that would be maximally developmentally facilitating for the less developed person in it, what would be the characteristics of that relation? Yeah. So you should be able to rattle off five or six ways that that relationship could be structured, or characteristics that it could have that would be good for the developing person. Positive affect, joint activities, gradual transfer of power to the less developed person toward equality, a high degree of reciprocity, those sorts of things. You should be able to do the same thing if we ask you how would you make a microsystem or a setting, the microsystem in a setting, developmentally facilitating. And you won't have to come up with those things out of your own head, although it would be nice if you could do that. We will give you a list and ask you to choose which of the following would make the microsystem or the setting more developmentally facilitating. There will be some in there that will be wrong. Don't mark them. Okay. We could ask the same thing about a mesosystem. If you wanted to make a mesosystem maximally developmentally facilitating, which of the following things would you do to it? Okay? So it's very objective. Just check the ones that are right. And then I like a section that gives you some right statements and wrong statements. And you just mark the ones that are right. true, false. But they're a little more than true, false. They're statements about the ecosystem using Bronfenbrenner's concepts. And then probably we'll give you a brief news story or a sketch of some kind, a little story, case study, and ask you a series of questions about it and ask you to interpret the story using Bronfenbrenner's concepts. So I might ask you, after you read this, to identify two or three dyads mentioned in the story, two or three settings. Is there an example of reciprocity? And then you have to dig out those characteristics or features from the story. Okay? It's just using it. Using the concepts. And just to make sure you've got the concepts and the basic principles clear. Probably in the past what we've done is say you can miss no more than five. So you have to know this stuff. So we'll cover some more of it today, and then we'll review everything on Wednesday, and then the review sessions will cover whatever you want. Plus, we'll give you some examples in the review session. Remind me to do an example for Wednesday. Bring an example. Okay? So Wednesday is the day particularly to bring all of your questions about everything you don't understand, and we'll try to go over them. Okay. Are we reasonably clear about the mesosystem? Relationships among settings, various ways they can be linked, and then a set of hypotheses about the similarity of mesosystem settings, the variety of linkages among settings, the positive affect between settings, valid information from one setting to the other, communication. All of those aspects of the mesosystem are connected to whether or not the settings that a person is in facilitate a person's development. And the general conclusion that you can draw from those hypotheses is that the more richly connected and the more mutually supportive the various settings in a mesosystem are, the better that will be for the developing person, for the person whose mesosystem it is. And sort of the big principle. It helps. That's interesting. You can see it. I can't. The computer is refusing to display. We'll get over it. Just checking. All right. So, if you are a developing person and you're going into a new setting, Bronfenbrenner thinks it would be useful if you knew something about that setting before you go into it. Does that help? Do you like going into the great unknown? Do you like not having a clue what's going to be expected? No, you don't. You like to go into settings where you have some idea. So if somebody invites you to a party, you want to know what will people be wearing. Right? You want to know who's going to be there. As you get older, you want to know which of your ex-partners will be there. Some of them you don't want to be with. What are we going to do? What should I bring? We ask for information about settings so that we can anticipate what's going to happen there. The more we know about what will happen in a setting, the more comfortable we are going into it and the more likely we are to be prepared. You like going to some place and not having what you need, right? That's always fun. You go to a party and be wearing the wrong thing. You like that, right? No. You want the information, and that makes it easier to go into the setting. It lets you take care of your anxiety before you go, and it lets you enter the setting with some familiarity with the expectations and the activities that are going to happen in that setting. And you'd like to know generally that you can do the things that are there. If I know I'm going to a party where everybody is a ping pong nut, and that's going to be the entertainment for the evening, I know you go to parties like that all the time, but everybody plays ping pong. I would probably actually be busy if I got that invitation. But if I knew I was going and it was a group of people I wanted to be with, I would probably practice so that I wouldn't be the bottom person on the totem pole. So I would get experience relevant to the particular setting. Okay, I think that one's fairly straightforward. And it helps if, as you go into a new setting, there's communication back and forth between other settings in your mesosystem. And Bronfenbrenner here is particularly thinking about what happens when a child goes to school, into a daycare center, into the Girl Scouts or Boy Scouts or whatever the person is going to be entering. And the assumption here is that if you provide information about what's going on in the new setting back to other settings that the child is in, the more communication there is about that experience, the more people in all the settings will be able to support the person's activities and development. Now, part of that is based on the expectation that people will talk about things that are going on in the other settings. And they're more likely to do that if they know what's going on in the other setting, particularly if you're dealing with a child. Remember when your parents ask you, "What did you do in school today?" And you said, "Nothing." And they wondered why they were paying taxes or tuition to send you to school. The child is not a very good provider of information to the home unit, to the home setting. But if the school, for example, provides information, a website, email that says to all the parents, "This is what we did this week. You might want to talk to your child about X, Y, or Z," parents are in a much better position, rather than asking, "What did you do in school today?" and hoping the kid remembers something, to be able to say, "Tell me about the math problems that you were doing." "Oh," the kid says, "math problems, I remember that." And then you can have a conversation. So the more information people in the home setting, for this example, have about what went on in the other setting, the more likely they are to be able to promote the child's rehearsal and understanding and continued exploration of what the activities were in the school setting. Does the same thing work the other way? If school knows what's going on at home, if parents communicate, teachers don't have time to ask 20 children to tell them in detail what's going on at home, what are their favorite things. But if home provides some information, then teachers are in a position to connect the math that they're doing to specific activities the child might be engaged in at home or in other settings. And any time you can make a connection for a child between something you're trying to teach and something the kid has already experienced, any time you can make that kind of connection, you increase the probability that the kid will make some sense out of what you're trying to teach, because you're accessing the experiences the child has already had. Now, kids are often eager to tell you experiences that they've had in school, whether they're true or at home in school. They take the stories from home to school. That's what I'm trying to say. And whether they're true or not, it's helpful if parents can validate the information the child is likely to take to school. It's also helpful if the parents can elaborate a little bit so teachers have enough to remember to connect to. Okay. Then kids can construct meaning out of the activities that are going on at school. Well, that's an important expectation in thinking about development constructively, because any time you can connect one activity or concept or principle that you're working on with a child to other experiences the child has had, any time you can do that, you increase the probability that it will make sense to the child and be useful to the child. So Bronfenbrenner's assuming that here, and he's going to go on to elaborate that in Hypothesis 43 by suggesting that if you have several settings and two or three or four transcontextual dyads, all of which engage in the same activities in the same settings, and what you have is a group mesosystem. You have a group of people who go from one setting to another and engage in activities together. And when you're in joint activity or primary dyads in those different settings, you create a closed activity network. And every member of the system engages in joint activities with every other member. This pattern is optimal if each party interacts with every other in each setting, and we're going to qualify it to say it's only going to help if gradually the balance of power shifts in favor of the developing person and those responsible for his or her well-being. Now, as I point out in the book, the notion of a closed activity network automatically sounds bad for us because we want everything to be open, right? What he means is that this is a shared set of activities and settings and relationships where people move from one setting to the other, engage in activities, the joint activity dyads with each other person, or primary dyads ideally, and that means that they're sharing a mesosystem, they're sharing the activities, and that will maximize the probability that they can talk about them and talk in one setting about what is happening in the other settings, can make the connections for the developing person among the activities and relationships that the developing person is experiencing in different settings. Okay. He doesn't mean by this hypothesis that your entire mesosystem, your entire ecosystem should be made up of a single closed activity network. What he means is that's going to be really helpful if you have a closed activity network, and then add all the other dyads and settings and relationships and activities to that. But what you're going to find as a focus of development, if it exists, is the closed activity network. Can you think of one that would be likely to happen? Any of you engage in a closed activity network? Your family, especially when you're a little kid. How is it a closed activity network? Okay. So you had an extended family, and you went from one house to the other, so those were different settings. Your parents went with you? Siblings?
Sometimes.
Okay, but for you, you and your parents created a closed activity network as you went from setting to setting. Did you go to church too?
No.
No. Oh, playground? Bowling?
Beach?
That's a setting? Went there with your parents? And members of the extended family? Okay. The family is the primary closed activity network that Bronfenbrenner is thinking of when he describes this hypothesis. What you're doing when you are raising children, if you are engaged in joint activity dyads with them in different settings, is taking them to church, the beach, grandma's house, bowling, maybe even school occasionally. Doing those things with the child so that you know what the kid's experience is. And so that having experienced it, the parents, who are one dyad, can talk at home, at night, in bed, or wherever they talk, about the teacher that they met and his or her attitude toward their child and how they might work better with the teacher to support their child's development. They can't do that if they haven't shared the experience of the teacher. They can't know very much about how the teacher relates to their child unless they have seen their child in that setting. What Bronfenbrenner is arguing is that the more you know about what's going on in the mesosystem of your child, the more experience you have in each of those settings, the more likely it is that you can be a supportive link, that you can provide information, you can create the positive attitude toward your child. You can help your child understand. You can give your child information about new settings. You can compare settings and activities and people for your child. You can help the child construct meaning of his or her experience in all the settings that she's in more effectively if you have shared the activities and the settings with the child. And the more people do that, the more people you have who share those experiences, the more likely you are to jointly create a valid understanding of the ecosystem and be able to help the child understand it. Okay? So the closed activity network isn't the only thing going on in the developing person's life, but it may be the central thing going on. Now, think about what happens if you don't have that. Some kids grow up in situations where their parents don't share any of their settings. They don't do things with them. They don't take them places. So kids' mesosystems don't overlap with the parents' mesosystems very well at all. They may not have siblings who go from place to place with them. Their ecosystem is much less richly connected. There's much less communication among the settings, much less valid understanding, and much less opportunity to help the child understand what's going on. So the kid comes home, wants to talk about school. Nobody at home has ever been there. Nobody at home has any image of what the teacher is like that might be valid. So they can't help the kid. You can't create a joint activity of understanding unless you're sharing the experience. Now think about kids whose families don't provide a closed activity network, but they may have one. And the closed activity network is likely to be the one that helps to validate your experience and give it meaning, to help you construct an understanding of the world. Lots of kids who don't have family closed activity networks have peer closed activity networks. They're in class, they're in sports, they're in the neighborhood, they're at the youth center, they're in trouble with peers. The peers are providing an understanding of the mesosystem. The peers are the ones that you go to because they can validate your experience across settings. The peers are providing the positive affect and the primary dyads and sharing the experience with you. Kids who have the peer closed activity network without a family network are more likely to be being raised by and developed by their peers, which for some kids may be really good, but for lots of us is not so good.
You can have both family close activity and peer close activity?
You can have both. You can have a really rich mesosystem. You can have a family that brings your peers along. You can have the family that provides the home where the peer group comes, where the bunch of friends hang out, and mom and dad make chocolate chip cookies. And the parents share the experience with the kids. Then the parents become influential in the larger ecosystem of the peers in the community because they know the kids and they know their experiences and they can help shape that. And you want them to be normal, positive people with a valid view of the world, not people who are going to share their pot with your kid and everybody else's kids, or deal drugs, or you know, whatever else they might be doing. Yeah, so you can have a positive closed activity network. You can also have one that's a little less positive. Okay? Is that concept reasonable? It's a closed activity network if the same relatively small, usually group of people go from setting to setting. Not every setting, but some settings. And engage in activities with each other. Oh, Bronfenbrenner really likes adults. So this hypothesis suggests that it's really good for kids to be in experiences with adults who aren't their parents. And that we have responsible, task-oriented, let's add molar in their activities, with adults other than the parents. Simply suggesting that it's good for you to experience other adults, other views of the world, other activities, and kids who have the opportunity to do that are learning more about the world than their parents may be able to teach them. And it's providing experiences with activities and roles and settings that are encouraging the child's development, perhaps more than the roles and activities at home may. Which is why many of you remember very fondly babysitting, doing childcare for other people's kids. You liked, didn't you? You still liked to go into somebody else's house. When I had kids and we would have babysitters, you know, we knew they really liked being at our house, especially after the kids went to bed. We'd put the kids down and we'd come home much later and they could look at the books. And they could see what was in the house and they could get an idea about decorating or not decorating in my case. Look at pictures. Watch television shows that their parents wouldn't let them watch. You all remember that. Raid the refrigerator. See what kind of liquor they had. Not raid the liquor, just see what. What do sophisticated college professors drink? You can find that out by looking in their liquor cabinets if you can get into their houses when they're not there, and babysitting is one of the opportunities to do that. Okay. We're going to back up a little bit. This one is incredibly long and complex. Okay. What does this mean? What this means is that all that stuff about having a richly linked mesosystem, lots of settings connected to each other, lots of information flowing back and forth, all of that is really, really important if you're a little kid. It's really, really important if you really need other people to show you the way, as little kids do. They need parents. They need people in other settings who are going to be responsible. They need teachers, they need coaches, they need piano teachers, they need adults who will monitor them and keep them out of trouble and help them understand what's going on. But, Bronfenbrenner says, as you develop, as you become more and more competent and confident, because you've had that kind of experience in your ecosystem, because you've had a richly connected mesosystem, you may get to the point where having a bunch of connections and people monitoring what you're doing and trying to help you, particularly people you already know, you may get to the point where that may be actually less good for your development than stepping out into something new by yourself. So Bronfenbrenner is suggesting that as you get good, you really understand your environment, you've had the benefit of a richly connected mesosystem, you've had lots of joint activities, there may come a point when you want to get away from your parents. You want to get away from your teachers, your peers, your friends, transcontextual dyads. Maybe you want to go to Europe for the summer. Maybe you want to get a job in another city for the summer. Maybe you want to join a group doing alternative spring break of people you don't really know and head off to Valdosta, Georgia, as an example, and meet a whole bunch of people you never met before and work for Habitat for Humanity. Bronfenbrenner says there comes a point when, if you are well developed, it may be important for you to test your skills, your ability to adapt to a new setting without all those rich connections that are generally good. So he's acknowledging that there comes a time when you understand your world well enough that you need to develop more confidence by jumping off into something new, which is why we promote study abroad and travel. And we promote not doing it with a whole class. Well, I think I'm not supposed to say this. Some of us promote not doing it with a whole bunch of your friends for the summer. How many of you have studied abroad for a period of time? Did you do it by yourself or with a big group? Was it better that way?
I think so.
You think so? Did you see people who were with other people from their own? What were they doing? They're hanging out with each other. You got more experience. Yeah. Glad you said that, because that's my experience, and the experience of many students that I've watched over the years have come back and said, man, am I glad I didn't know anybody on that trip, because there were 7 students from Syracuse who were all in the same major and all in the same sorority, and they were all there, and they didn't learn anything because they hung out with each other. And I got a chance, I met all kinds of people who didn't speak English, and I went off, I had lots of fun and adventure with them, and I learned a great deal about the culture. And the 7 students, I'm picking on Syracuse for no particular reason. They sponsor a number of study abroad programs, that's why. And they missed the whole experience of going into that kind of setting. For me, the fun one was the summer job between junior and senior year in college, which involved filling out an application wrote them a letter. They hired me. Sight unseen. Just nothing, you know, for the summer. Gave me a place to stay on campus. I knew I was going to be working with kids with problems. And I got on a bus in the evening in Boston, overnight bus to Cleveland. Didn't have to pay for a hotel room that way. But that's the way you do it. You sleep on the bus. Got to Cleveland, found a city bus that would take me where I was going, and the driver would make sure I didn't get lost. Got off, walked onto the grounds of this residential treatment center for emotionally disturbed kids. First thing I saw, here I am with my suitcases, okay. Not knowing what I was going to do, not knowing anybody, nothing. And the first kid I saw was randomly taking bottles out of his jacket pocket and throwing them up as high as he could and watching them smash on the sidewalk. And oh, this is, you know, fun. And it was wonderful. I didn't know anybody there. I had to meet the other summer counselors. We had a great time. Learned a tremendous amount. In fact, led me directly here. That's why I'm here. Because I like working with emotionally disturbed young people. No, I like teaching people about development and parenting and families so that you won't produce another group of emotionally disturbed young people. Okay. Many of us remember those jumping off into the wild unknown experiences as being formative to our development. And that's Brun from Brenner's point, that I wouldn't be where I am had I not done that. And it was pretty much a fluke that I did it, but it turned out that I was ready to do it. I didn't know it, and I hadn't read Bronfenbrenner. Okay, another complicated one. Yeah. Now we're going to move to talking not just about the fact that we have a mesosystem at any particular time with settings that are related to each other. Now we're going to get to some of the meat of development in Bronfenbrenner's framework. And the basic notion here is that over time, this is time left to right, you're going to pass through a variety of settings. Remember kindergarten? Right? You remember kindergarten? It's not in your current mesosystem, right? None of you, well, some of you some of you hang out in kindergartens, don't you? Early childhood majors, elementary ed. Some of us do. But not the ones we went to, and not the with the teachers that we had. And we're not there as students. We may be there as student teachers. We had kindergarten. Some of us had nursery school. We had kindergarten. We had first grade. We had second grade. We had third grade. We had middle school. We had high school. We have college. Some of you are going to have graduate school. Okay. Those are all related settings. Some of us had ice rinks when we were two or three. How many of you put on skates when you were two or three? How many of you still skate? You still skate in the same skates? Probably not. In the same rink? No? Okay. Different rinks. How many of you would like to live in a city, those of you who skate, a city where you would not have the opportunity to skate? You want to skate? No. How many of you actively skate now? Okay. You want to keep skating? Yeah. Yeah? Okay. So, if you had your choice between a city that had a hockey rink or a skating facility and one that didn't, and everything else about them was the same, would you choose a hockey rink city? Sure you would. Of course you would. If you don't, Bronfenbrenner's wrong. So, you have to. Do it the Bronfenbrenner way. Okay. The point of this isn't well, it is sort of a hypothesis. It's really a definition, which is that sometimes you get started in one setting. It may be a hockey rink. It may be a pony ride. It may be a basketball court. It may be school. It may be a piano lesson when you're five. You start something in a setting that is continued in later settings. So the activity carries over into another setting. And it gets reinforced there. It gets practiced. It gets more complex. And that leads to another setting where it gets practiced and reinforced and perhaps more complex. And in each of those settings, there are relationships and activities that support the activity. There are roles that support the activity. The activity is changing, you know, from here we go up a road to a birthday party with one finger on the piano. That's here. Okay. And then maybe some simpler but more complex, simple but more complex songs. And then maybe a little Gershwin. And then maybe a little whatever. The activity is getting more complex. And maybe it goes from learning to read music to playing the piano to playing the piano to playing the piano in a quartet to composing for the piano. Ah, there's another twist. Okay. From reading music to playing in a group, to composing for the piano, to composing for a group, to conducting the London Symphony. You can fill in all of the details. What Bronfenbrenner is suggesting is that that makes up life. That's life. A series of settings over time that reinforce activities that develop importance for you. They become persisting patterns of motivation and activity. You liked skating. You liked skating with a hockey stick. You liked running around with the puck. You liked playing hockey in the Pee Wee League. You moved on to hockey in high school. You got a hockey scholarship at UVM. You play for the Canadiens. You go to the Olympics. You lose. Oh, well. Sorry, they don't pay much for playing in the Olympics. The same players who just didn't win a medal are back this week earning their millions of dollars. Okay. That's a developmental trajectory from very simple to increasing complexity, more and more motivation if you stick with it. And that becomes a defining molar activity for your life. If you go back in your own history to think about all of the things that you like to do now, you should be able to find the settings, to define the settings and the activities that led to those complex molar activities that you engage in now. All of you have developmental trajectories of school. You all did reasonably well. You were all motivated to do your homework, to apply to college. So it went from nursery school to kindergarten to middle school to high school to here you are, and some of you are heading to graduate school. For some of us, that continues because here I am. School was so comfortable, such a familiar setting, and the activities in it were so interesting that I still do it. I am going to graduate, but not for a bit. Great question. What is the trajectory? Well, it's the persisting pattern of motivation and activity in the individual that is a developmental trajectory. It's the result of participating in a series of primary settings with microsystems that reinforce those molar activities that were brought into them. So it's the persistent pattern of motivation and activity, the desire to do something, that he describes as the developmental trajectory. But to understand it and how it developed, you need to go back and look at the settings and the activities and the roles and relationships in those microsystems that encouraged that persistent pattern of motivation and activity. Okay? So the fun thing is to go back and figure out how you develop the interests that you have. Where did those come from? What settings got those started, got the ball rolling? Which settings reinforced it? And then you can think about the people who got you into those settings. So if you're going to be a musician, there are probably very early settings that led to other settings that led to the musical skills that you have and the interest and the understanding. If you're an academic, you have academic settings. If you're a soccer player, at some point somebody put a ball in front of your foot and probably got you onto different fields, into different settings where that activity could become more and more complex and you could learn more and more about it. If you want to be a nurse, you probably had some experience with healthcare someplace along the line. I've been fascinated. Every once in a while you pick up a theme, a series of people, a group of people who have similar developmental trajectories. One of the things that you can do with the Human Development and Family Studies major is become a child life specialist in pediatrics in a hospital. And work with what's well about the kids who are in the hospital. And you can do an internship in that. You can eventually get certified. You can do a master's at two or three universities and actually make a living helping kids and their families deal with hospital settings. I've had a number of students who've done that, and it was interesting to me at one point that three out of four, I had four who did it over the course of a three-year period. Three of those four had been premature babies. And they all connected their knowledge that they were premature with their interest in working in pediatrics. And I have been fascinated by how that early setting, the setting you entered before you were actually scheduled to be born, if you were premature, the intensive care nursery, what does that do to the brain that makes people want to continue into working with kids and their families in pediatrics? It fascinated me. I don't have an answer, but it's a developmental trajectory because all of them had moved from the intensive care nursery eventually to candy striping and volunteering in hospitals and doing high school activities related to pediatrics and then college and then graduate school or internships after that. If you get started on a developmental trajectory, the reason I drew this way is that what happens as you go from setting to setting across time is that you tend to focus on settings that will support the activity you are in. So if you could go to three different settings from this one that I'll label B, one of the determinants, if you have a choice, one of the determinants of which setting you will choose to go into is which one is most directly connected to the activity that is supported in B. So for some students, for example, choice of college is based on whether or not you can play football there. And if football is an important trajectory for you, you don't go to UVM. You don't even consider it. Those turkeys up there in Vermont don't even play football. How do you possibly have a major university that doesn't play football? Some alumni are still asking that. And there are students who don't choose UVM. They specifically exclude UVM because we don't play football. There are other students who don't come here because the dance program is not significantly good. We don't have a dance faculty of four. Where do you want to go if you want to do dance? I had a student in class about 3 years ago who was a master's student in education, and she was working with small business, who's really very bright, wanted to know something about adolescence. I ran into her over the break between semesters, asked her what she was doing, assuming that she was doing something in education. She's getting a PhD, working on her doctoral dissertation. In what? Tango. Tango. She is at Temple University, which has one of the finest dance programs in the world. She's getting a PhD in dance, specializing in tango. I didn't know she was on that developmental trajectory, so I asked her, where the hell did that come from? She's been dancing since she was a child. She took tango in high school. She traveled to Argentina. I didn't know it when she was a student, master's student. She was dancing and teaching dance, and now she's going to go off and be a faculty member teaching dance with a specialty in tango. She chose Temple because they have the program. And as soon as she finishes her doctorate, she's off for a postdoctoral year in Paris to work with one of Astor Piazzolla's former students. You pick the settings that support the interests that you've developed in previous settings. And sometimes you can't do that. Sometimes there's no setting open for you. So your career comes to a grinding halt. Or the settings that you're in don't support it. I woke up this morning, you don't need to know this, but I'll tell you anyway. I woke up this morning thinking about music and realizing that when I was in graduate school, my father sold my trombone with my permission. And I was grieving a little bit 40 years later about the fact that I don't have a trombone. And I wondered, what would have happened if instead of letting him sell it, he called and asked, you want this thing? Get it out of the closet. I said, no. What would have happened? What would my trajectory have been had I been playing trombone for the last 40 years? You know?
No.
No. Okay. All right. Okay, if I understand your question, let me elaborate. A molar activity can become more complex within a setting. You know, you're going to take lessons, you're going to study, you're going to maybe be in graduate school for 4 years as a single setting. Your understanding is going to become more complex. You're going to take on more responsibility in the activity. So that can happen in any particular setting. And then what Bronfenbrenner is interested in is how you move from setting to setting in ways that will support the increasing complexity. So there may be a limit to what you can do in kindergarten. How far can you go during a year in kindergarten? So then you need elementary school. And there's a limit to what can happen in elementary school. Or for some of you who dance, there may be limits to what you can do in a particular studio. And so as you get older, you look for a studio with more advanced instruction. And you choose that setting to make it more complex. So it depends on what the possibilities are in a particular setting and how long you can stay there, and then what other settings are open to you. If you want to become, I'll use an example from my own family. If you want to become an Aikido master, Aikido is a martial art, right? If you want to become a master, you have to study with masters. And as you get more and more skilled, you have to find masters who can test you, who can challenge you, who are better than you. So you're constantly looking for a studio, a dojo, where you can practice with people who can actually still teach you something. Because if you're constantly practicing with people who are less skilled than you are, you're not meeting the challenges that you need. Okay. So you seek out, and this is the basic point, you seek out settings that can encourage and support the activity that is making up this developmental trajectory. If you can't enter the next setting, or the next setting doesn't support it, there's no trombone there, or no dance, or no horse barn, so you can't bring your horse to UVM. We do have one, which is why some students pick us, because you can bring your horse to UVM. You pick it, you pick your settings, or the absence of settings to choose keeps you from continuing the trajectory. So Bronfenbrenner is going to take that notion and suggest that where you can go developmentally is in part determined by what settings are open and closed to you. The probability that I would have become a hockey player growing up in central and southern Illinois was about zero. We occasionally pretended to play hockey, those of us who had ever seen it, on a frozen pond, which happened where I grew up for maybe part of the month of January. We didn't have hockey rinks. Never, ever. The settings were closed to me simply because of the geography and the fact that the town was too small. Forty-five years later, they still don't have a hockey rink, and they never will. It's not going to happen. So hockey players are not going to come out of Greene County, Illinois, or Jackson County, Illinois. Why would settings be open or closed to you? Geography, in my case. Poverty, in many cases. Or back in the old days, because you were female. That's what Title IX is about. Making sure that women have the opportunity to enter settings where they can develop athletic skills, rather than be excluded. Science courses, because you were female. Or in my case, in high school, because I was male, I couldn't take home economics courses. They were closed to men. I don't know why, but they didn't want me to learn to cook. Junior high school, we got 6 weeks of cookie baking. But the rest of the year was woodworking and metalworking for the boys. The girls got 6 weeks of woodworking and the rest of the year was cooking and sewing. We were not permitted to learn to cook or sew. Those are the old days. We're over that, right? Another example of a closed setting. Laboratory buildings at the University of Pittsburgh, when I was teaching there in 1970, laboratory courses in biology were not open to anybody who couldn't walk up a flight of stairs. If you were in a wheelchair, you couldn't take a lab course in biology because all the labs were held in a building that had stairs to get to the labs and no elevator and no ramps. So you couldn't get there. So you were not permitted to take the courses if you used a wheelchair.
Is that illegal?
Not then. You know why it became illegal? Because Vietnam and the civil rights era. One of the fun things that happened at the University of Pittsburgh and other places when vets came back in wheelchairs was that they decided not to let the university shut them out of biology labs because they were in wheelchairs. So they just closed the building, said, nobody's going in here if we can't. It was great. They also couldn't cross the street. Pittsburgh is an urban campus with two big streets that go through the campus. And to get from the psychology department on this corner to the main classroom building and the library on the other corner, you had to cross the street, which is no problem if you're in a wheelchair, except that the curbs were very high. And there were no curb cuts because people in wheelchairs weren't supposed to be there. They weren't supposed to go anywhere, right? So the settings were closed to people in wheelchairs until one day when a group of the vets gathered at the major corner outside the psychology department building and blocked off traffic and got a couple of their football team buddies with sledgehammers to start creating curb cuts. That's called civil disobedience. And a group of us were cheering them on. And Pittsburgh's finest showed up in blue. And they asked what was going on. And the vets explained that they couldn't get from one building to the other because they're... We didn't even have the term curb cut at the point. There was no way to get down, so they were altering the curbs. And we were standing waiting for the police to start issuing tickets and arresting people, and the cops said, okay, let's see, we need to divert the traffic over here, so I'll go direct traffic there. If you need more sledgehammers, we can probably get those. And let's get a group here. You know, let's trade off. So the police were very supportive of that. But that was 10, 12, 15 years before equal opportunity for disabled Americans, which opened settings like this one to people in wheelchairs or people on crutches or blind students or people who can't hear. All of those conditions kept people out of settings where they might have developed. Okay. Let's look at 48 for a minute. Continuing the notion of a trajectory, Bronfenbrenner is interested in what happens as you move from setting to setting and how you know that development has happened. And what he suggests is that you may not know that development has happened until you move from one setting to another. Okay. Primary setting being one that kicks off or supports a developmental trajectory. And he says, we may not see how much you've developed in a particular setting, how much you've learned and how much you understand, until we throw you into another setting that allows you to manifest the new understanding and the skills that you have. We need to put you in another setting where you can take initiative to learn what's going on and to contribute in that setting. And he's going to call that a primary transition. This is not a hugely important point. I wouldn't ask you a question about primary setting or primary transition. But the point is that sometimes you don't know how good you are, and nobody else may know how good you are until you get into a new setting that allows you to be good. One of the things that often surprises parents is that they have never seen evidence that their kid knows how to organize his room or do laundry or feed himself until he gets out into someplace else. Believe it or not, there are people who come to college and take care of themselves quite well. And their parents are often quite amazed. They didn't know that he could do that. That's a sleeper effect. They really did learn something at home and then got into a setting where nobody else was going to do it for them so they could actually do it. And finally, in this particular thread, what's important is the match between what was going on in one setting, what was expected, what the activities were, and what's expected, what the activities are, what the opportunities are in the next setting. So as you move from place to place, as you go from high school to college, one of the important pieces in having that transition go well is that there be a match between what you learned in high school and what's required in college. Some of us have that. Some of us didn't. When I was in academic difficulty my freshman year of college, the thing that helped most was that my advisor was able to say, you know, you had a fun time in high school, and it was a really nice small place. You didn't learn anything that would be useful in college. But you're good. You'll learn. So he just reassured me that I didn't know anything, and it wasn't my fault. But I would learn. I hope he's right. And we'll see you on Wednesday. Bring your questions.